One of the earliest Christian authors whose writings we still possess was a man named Tertullian. Well, Quintus Septimius Florens Tertullianus, to be precise, but Tertullian for short. He was born in Roman North Africa in the middle of the 2nd century, and after becoming a Christian, he wrote a number of treatises defending Christianity from both from criticism from without and heresy from within. In addition, Tertullian also wrote a series of treatises that he addressed to believers, where he took up the subject of how Christians ought to live in the Roman culture in which they find themselves. And the first topic that he took up in those treatises is that of idolatry, because the temptation toward idolatry was, for Tertullian, the greatest danger that he and his fellow Christians faced. As he put it in the opening words of his treatise, idolatry is the chief crime of mankind, the supreme guilt of the world. For even if every sin retains its own identity, and even if each is destined for judgment under its own name, each is still committed within idolatry. Perhaps it should come as no surprise that Tertullian regards idolatry as such a grave moral threat, or that he dedicates an entire treatise to helping early Christians avoid it in their day-to-day lives. After all, isn't that also where the Ten Commandments begin? With 2 commandments prohibiting the making of idols and worshiping false gods? For the same reason, we shouldn't be surprised that when Moses begins his discussion of specific commandments in Deuteronomy chapter 12, when he begins this new section, we shouldn't be surprised that he begins with a denunciation of idolatry. Actually, Moses goes even further than that. He doesn't just tell the people to denounce idols. He tells them to utterly destroy every trace of idolatry. You, he says, shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you are to dispossess worshiped their gods, on the high mountains and in the valleys and under every lush tree. And you shall smash their altars and shatter their sacred pillars, and their cultic poles you shall burn in fire, and the images of their gods you shall chop down, and you shall destroy their name from that place. God didn't just ask his people to avoid idolatry. He commanded them to utterly eradicate every trace of it from their new homeland. He wanted them to obliterate the very memory of the gods whom the Canaanites had worshipped. Don't just destroy the worship sites, he said. You shall destroy their name from that place. What's more, God doesn't just instruct the Israelites to destroy the Canaanite gods or their worship places. He also insists that they must never worship him in the same places or in the same manner that the Canaanites worship their deities. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, he says. Later in the chapter, in verse 31, he repeats this command, this time with a bit more explanation. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, for every abominable thing that the Lord hates, they have done for their gods. For they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Whether or not child sacrifice was widespread among the ancient Canaanites is uncertain. We do know that it occurred, though not how frequently. But the mention of child sacrifice here, it's not meant to be the only way in which God doesn't want the Israelites to imitate the worship of their neighbors. It's just one example. Elsewhere, God also condemns things like the cultic prostitution that was so common in Canaanite worship, as well as the superstitious rituals of magic and divination. Worship was a daily reality in the world of the ancient Near East. Altars and sacrifices to the gods were everywhere. Of course, God wasn't telling Israel to stop worshiping. Worship was meant to be a daily reality for them, as much as it was for their neighbors. But what mattered wasn't whether or not they worshiped. It was whom they worshiped and how. That's what Moses is telling them in this chapter of Deuteronomy. That's what God is commanding them. Not that they stop all this constant worshiping that's going on in Canaan, but that they put an end to the worship of idolatry and of the immorality and the injustice that comes from it. And that they worship God alone, and that they worship Him only in the way He commands. That's why in verse 5, right after Moses tells them to destroy the places of Canaanite worship and to destroy the names of their gods, it's why he says, "But you shall seek the place that the Lord your God will choose out of all your tribes to put His name and make His habitation there. There you shall go, and there you shall bring your burnt offerings and sacrifices, your tithes and the contributions that you present, your vow offerings, your free will offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock." The point here isn't that there's one place that's more sacred than all other places. In fact, Moses doesn't even name the place where the Israelites will worship. He just says that it will be a place of God's choosing. It will be a place where God chooses to make His habitation. Because what matters isn't ultimately the place of worship. What matters is that within their worship that the Israelites are acknowledging that God is God and they are not. Worship is not meant to be a way or a means of manipulating some powerful force to get what you want, as it was with the Canaanites. Worship is meant to be a way of recognizing that God is God and we are creatures, that He is the one who directs us. We do not direct Him, and that everything that we have and that everything we enjoy is a result of His goodness and His provision. It's also why you might notice, it's why the acts of worship that Moses mentions in verse 5, they're not focused on the Levitical sacrifices of atonement for sin that you read about in the book of Leviticus, all those sacrifices for sin and for guilt. Those are certainly important. But rather here, Moses mentions expressions of celebration and thanksgiving. The burnt offerings and sacrifices, the tithes, the contributions, the free will offerings, the firstborn animals. All of these things are different forms of sacrificial offerings that are given in gratitude to God, to acknowledge His provision. The Canaanites worshipped in ways that tried to manipulate the gods to give them what they wanted. The Israelites were being commanded to do something else, to worship in a way that acknowledged that God had already provided and that He would continue to provide everything that they could possibly need. What's more, notice how, whereas Canaanite worship often involved abusive treatment of slaves and of prostitutes and sometimes even human sacrifice, the Israelites were commanded to worship in a way that was both morally pure and socially responsible. God had already commanded them in Leviticus chapter 19 to love their neighbors as themselves. Now, here in Deuteronomy 12, He explains that this love of neighbor must be present in their worship as well. "And you," He says, "shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your male servants and your female servants, and the Levite that is within your towns, since he has no portion of inheritance with you." Centuries later, through the mouth of the prophet Isaiah, God will tell the Jewish people that He has come to a point where He hates their sacrifices and their offerings, because they have the audacity to worship Him while mistreating those who are poor and vulnerable among them. But already here in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses is already making the same point. Idolatry is what leads to the abuse and mistreatment of your neighbor. Israel's worship must do the opposite. That's the main theme of chapter 12. But the theme of idolatry doesn't end there. It continues in chapter 13, where Moses turns his attention from the commandment against idols or false gods to instructions about how to prevent idolatry from ever arising in the first place. In Deuteronomy 13, Moses warns against three different groups of people who could potentially lead the Israelites into idolatry. First, in verses 1 through 5, he warns against the danger of false prophets. If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or wonder, and the sign or wonder that he tells you comes to pass, and if he says, "Let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them," you shall not listen. Interestingly, later in the book of Deuteronomy, in chapter 18, Moses says that one of the key ways to tell if someone is a false prophet is to see whether or not what they say actually comes true. But here in chapter 13, he says that even if you have some great religious leader arise and that person makes predictions and they come true, even then, if he begins to lead you away to the worship of other gods, you are to have nothing to do with them. In fact, he tells them you must put that person to death because he has taught rebellion against the one true Lord. But that's not the only danger. After warning against false prophets, Moses next warns against the influence of friends and family members. If your brother, he says, or son, or daughter, or wife, or friend induces you to commit idolatry, you shall have nothing to do with them. And again, Moses goes even so far as to say that such a person, such a family member or friend must be put to death. Of course, there's very little evidence that this punishment was hardly ever carried out. Nor certainly does anything in the New Testament suggest that Christians ought to be putting people to death for idolatry. But like Moses, keep in mind, Jesus also warns his own followers against letting their ties to friends and family members interfere with the exclusive loyalty they owe to God. If anyone, Jesus says, comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Now, Jesus' consistent teaching elsewhere, as well as the parallel record of this saying in the Gospel of Matthew, they both make it obvious that Jesus isn't actually commanding his followers to feel some kind of literal hatred toward their families. But he is insisting that his followers not allow their love or loyalty for their family to turn them away from following him. In the same way, God is not telling the Israelites that they shouldn't love their family or friends. The book of Deuteronomy is filled with commands about how they should do exactly that. But he is recognizing the powerful influence that those we love, our family and friends, that they have over us. And he's warning that no matter what, we must never allow that influence to lead us to worshiping false gods. If it comes down to a choice between our loyalty to God and our loyalty to our family, it is the latter which must always be sacrificed. That's just how important this is. Finally, after mentioning false prophets and family and friends, Moses turns his attention to the danger of charismatic political leaders. If you hear, he says, if you hear about men who have come to some city and they've captured the attention of its citizens and they've managed to turn their loyalty away from God, then he says you must go and put an end not only to those charismatic political leaders who've led the people astray, but to the entire city. You shall surely put the inhabitants of that city to the sword, devoting it to destruction, all who were in it and its cattle. Now, most people who read these words today, most people are rather horrified by the violence that God is commanding of his people. And no doubt many modern readers, when they come across these passages, no doubt they'll be reminded of some of the terrible acts of violence, some of the atrocity that's been committed over the years in the name of religion, even in the name of the Christian religion. Now, I admit to feeling some of those feelings myself when I read these chapters. And I also admit that these exhortations to violent punishment and execution, that they raise some serious questions that I simply don't really have the time to answer in this video. But I would like to make two simple observations about these consequences. First, the book of Deuteronomy is very clear elsewhere in its condemnation of violence and the shedding of blood. In no way does Deuteronomy reject the prohibition of murder that God gives in chapter 5 in the Ten Commandments. So the fact that God demands destruction here, it's not meant to be an endorsement of violence, but it is a recognition of the severity of idolatry and of just how easy idolatry can spread. Idolatry is what leads to widespread social injustice, abuse, and ultimately death, and it cannot be tolerated. Second, with these warnings, Moses is also making it clear just how subtly and how easily we may be led astray into idolatry. It can come through successful religious leaders. It can come through persuasive politicians. Even the influence of family and friends can incline us to worship false gods. Now, of course, at this point, you might be asking, well, what does any of this have to do with me? I certainly don't live in the ancient Near East. I'm not surrounded by pagan altars or idols. I've never burnt any incense, and I have certainly never sacrificed a child to some pagan deity. And yet, even though we live in a very different cultural context, that doesn't mean that idolatry is no longer a problem, or that we no longer experience the temptation to go after other gods. To the contrary, as the American novelist David Foster Wallace, though himself not religious, but as he so candidly acknowledged, there is no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. We all worship. We all give ourselves over to something. Martin Luther, the Protestant reformer, once said that a god is really anything you look to as a source of all good in your life, and it's anything that you turn to as a refuge in fear or distress, something that provides you meaning or happiness, and something that can protect you from harm. That's your god. And the dangerous thing about worshiping anything other than God, as Moses points out, is that anything else you will worship will ultimately destroy you, just as it was doing with the Canaanites. Or, as David Foster Wallace himself admits, anything else you worship, as he puts it, will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power. You will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect. Being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. Those aren't the words of some religious authority. In fact, they're not even the words of a religious man. Those are just the honest observations of someone who knows both the power and the danger of worship. And God understands this as well. And that's why in Deuteronomy 12 and 13, he begins his instructions the way that he does, by focusing his attention on the most important matter of all, on what we worship and how. As the Apostle John says in the very last sentence of his own letter in the New Testament, "Little children, keep yourselves from idols."